they are going to be staying home. Both my kids, you know, really need better supervision and not like the craziness and chaos and noise that's going to be happening. I don't think it's right for them to be in an unsafe and really unsupervised situation.
And that's even if the LAUSD is saying, as they are, please send your kids to school still.
That's what they're saying, but I don't believe them that it's going to be safe.
Los Angeles teachers are likely headed for a strike later this week. The union and LAUSD officials failed to come to an agreement yesterday after a long day of last-ditch negotiations. The two sides are expected to meet again tomorrow, one day before teachers would head to the picket lines. And if talks fall apart again, it would be the first teachers' strike in 30 years. Alex Caputo-Pearl is president of the teachers' union, United Teachers of Los Angeles, and he joins me now. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, yesterday the district offered an extra $75 million to hire more nurses, teachers, and librarians. So that brings the total to $105 million they are proposing. And so that is actually more than an independent fact-finding panel determined necessary to pay for additional staff. What were your objections?
Two problems with that. One is that their proposal actually raised class size permanently within the contract across the board. So you would have class sizes able to go as high as 39 students in elementary school and 46 students in high school. That's unacceptable. They also are keeping a provision that would allow them to blow through those class size caps even higher than 39 and 46. And then the problem with the additional staffing is that this $105 million towards additional staffing is that it's only a one-year commitment. It's less than 5% of the $2 billion reserve that they're sitting on right now. And it would end up bringing only one additional staff person per school to schools across the city. And that's just not enough to do class size reduction and have full-time nurses and counselors and so on.
Okay. So what is the amount of money that would satisfy your demands? What do you want from the district?
Well, for class size reduction alone, and this $105 million that they put across the table was for class size reduction and nurses, librarians, psychologists, et cetera. So for class size reduction alone, to really make a dent in it, you're going to need $200 million. And then you're going to need additional money to make sure that full-time nurses, counselors, et cetera, are in place. You know, 80% of schools in the L.A. school district right now do not have full-time nurses. We've got to shift that around so that our students are taken care of.
And how much money would that be then?
Well, you're talking about some additional tens of millions of dollars for that as well.
Okay. Now, you talk a lot about this $2 billion reserve. That is a number that is up for debate. The district says, yeah, we have that $2 billion, but it's already accounted for. A large portion of that would go towards the raise that teachers are going to get, this 6% raise over the next 3 years, leaving about $700 million or so over the next 3 years. So most of it already accounted for. Do you dispute that?
We do dispute that. And an across-the-board raise would, again, only be around the 10% sort of proportion of that reserve. Here's the issue. They ended the 2017-18 school year with a $1.86 billion reserve. That's in the district's own documents. Then in December, less than a month ago, they said that that had actually grown to $2.05 billion. In reserve. So it's actually growing as it has for the last 5 years. And their numbers are, when they project out to this fiscal cliff that's supposed to happen 3 years from now, they're consistently wrong on that. They predicted, 3 years ago, they predicted that they would have a $105 million reserve right now. They were off by $1.7 billion. That's a lot to be off by.
Do you have an independent assessment of their finances that you're relying on, or are you just basing your analysis on past behavior?
We do. We've got a research department that has forensic accountants in it, and we also work with the state policymakers and state unions to come up with an analysis of their budget. One of the problems is that they have not been forthcoming with public records, so we have an unfair practice charge against them that's in court right now because they've refused to produce financial documents that we need to get into the budget more. But the numbers that we have are right on the mark.
But you don't dispute that there is a larger, more structural problem that involves paying for pensions and health care costs for retirees, as well as the other problem, which is declining enrollment, meaning less revenue. And there is one projection that shows that by around 2030 or so, half of the district's budget will go to paying retiree health care benefits and pensions. Half. That is an unsustainable number, correct?
Well, there's a couple things that we're doing around this issue. California is 43rd out of 50 among the states in per pupil funding, which is criminal when you're looking at the richest state in the country. And we've been very aggressive in Sacramento. We're working with a statewide coalition to get, and we actually qualified Schools and Communities First for the ballot in November of 2020, which would close the corporate loophole within Proposition 13 and bring about $5 billion into public schools. Austin Buettner could also work with his private equity and hedge fund manager friends. That's the world he comes out of. He doesn't come out of education. And actually sponsor legislation to close the carried interest loophole, which allows hedge fund managers to incorrectly classify income as capital gains. That could also bring money to schools. So we're very aggressive in Sacramento, and we're going to continue to do that. But there's money here in L.A. that our students deserve now, and then we need to continue pushing that strategy in Sacramento.
Right. So I guess that my next question was, isn't your real beef with Sacramento? 80% of the funding for LAUSD comes from the state. So shouldn't your argument be with them and not with Austin Buettner?
Austin Buettner is trying to use talking about the state as a decoy, saying don't focus on the $2 billion reserve that LAUSD has. We're not interested in decoys. We're interested in results for our kids. So we are going after a $2 billion reserve, a record-breaking reserve here in L.A., and we're pursuing work in Sacramento, not just around per-pupil funding, but also around regulation of charter schools. This is another huge issue. Neighborhood public schools have about $600 million per year drained out of them by the unregulated growth of charter schools that often don't serve all students, often don't serve special education students, and often have very significant problems with transparency. You just had the Celerity Charter School principal put in jail for having a $500,000 salary mm-hmm. on taxpayer dollars.
But these are state-funded schools that are approved by the state. This is also a problem that you would have with the state, not with the district.
The district, there are things that the district can do, like requiring community impact reports, educational impact reports, of charters. The district can also make sure that when charters are co-located on public district campuses, that there are rules of engagement. And the district so far hasn't been willing to do any of that at the bargaining table or at outside policy tables.
Can you explain to us why the district would defend charter schools if students going to charter schools means less money for the district because the money follows the child? And when a child goes to a charter school, that money doesn't go to the district.
I mean, it gets to the one of the broader issues of the privatization of public education. Austin Buettner, as you know, is an investment banker with corporate downsizing experience and not education experience. We actually are growing tired of his bargaining tactics, where he, routinely says things that aren't true in the media and to parents. So we're growing tired of that. But he comes out of a privatization-backed and charter industry-backed majority on the school board. The industry bought the school board for $13 million last year in the most expensive race in U.S. history. And they are promoting a privatization agenda and a downsizing agenda, which, has hit other sectors, whether you're looking at healthcare, other sectors. Now they're trying to bring it to public education, and it's not acceptable.
But what evidence do you have that they actually want to do that? I mean, are you saying that they just want to destroy the LA public school system?
Yes. So Austin Buettner has brought on board consultants. He's brought on Kitamba Consulting Firm, which worked in Washington, D.C., has also brought on Third Way Consulting Firm. They worked in Newark, and these were consulting firms that led the efforts at dismantling the public school districts in New Orleans, Washington, D.C., Detroit, Indianapolis, other places. It's very clear what the agenda is.
Okay, it seems that there's a lot of bad blood between you and Austin Buettner. Is that a fair way of describing it?
I have nothing against him personally. I do think that the superintendent should have education experience, and he doesn't, and should not have corporate downsizing experience, and he does. When we met with the district yesterday, and we're going to meet with them again tomorrow, it was diplomatic. I mean, there were certainly disagreements, and there were moments of tension, but we know how to be diplomatic, and we're going to continue to be so. And we have a bargaining team, and he's got a bargaining team, and that group of people together on our side, that's educators from across the city who are trained in bargaining and know educational issues backwards and forwards. We're gonna rely on that team process to go in with an open mind tomorrow and try to reach an agreement.
Can you take what they've offered so far and say, all right, we will agree not to go on strike, but only if you agree to continue negotiating on these other points?
We don't want to do that, and here's why. Buettner has really tried to narrow things to just salary, and we're not going to be bought off. We are working with parents across the city, with youth organizations, with community groups, with clergy, who want to see broader issues dealt with.
All right, finally, you go out on strike. If you go out on strike, how long, reasonably, would you expect to be out on strike?
So it's really on the district how long it will be. We obviously would want it to be short, and we would ask for parents to continue being involved, as we've seen them being involved in a very positive way over the last weeks.
But you don't know if it'll be a couple days or it could drag on longer, a lot longer?
Difficult to say, but our schools have been the subject of underfunding and the subject of a privatization endeavor for well over a decade, and if it takes a short amount of time of disruption to actually turn around that 10-year disruption to our kids, then we'll do that. But we expect that it will be short and that people will be very involved, and we want the district to come to the table with real substantive proposals to end it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
That's Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of United Teachers Los Angeles. And joining us now for a bigger picture is Pedro Noguera, distinguished professor of education at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Okay, so there's this big sticking point, and it's a big one. It's $2 billion. And Alex Caputo-Pearl just said that the district is not being entirely above board about that money, saying that they could easily spend that money on the union's demands. The district saying, no, 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 most of that money, if not all of it, is already accounted for. Where does the truth lie?
It's really hard to tell. If you listen to the district, they're running out of funds, and they are faced with a structural deficit, and the county has said the same thing and threatened that they will take them over if they don't get their finances in order. You listen to the union says they got plenty of money. So hard for me to know. I know that there have been several reports saying that the district's finances are in trouble, that they're running a structural deficit. And that's been, there are several objective parties that have found that to be the case. So whether or not they have the money, I mean, clearly we need lower class sizes. So I think there's validity to the demand. The question is, where does the money come from?
Right. And so do you see any hope of them coming together on this issue? They seem so far apart.
Yeah, I think there needs some intervention. And, and I wrote an op-ed that appeared yesterday in the L.A. Times trying to get the mayor to play a role. Even though he doesn't have a formal role, I think he could play a role. If not him, then maybe the new governor. Because it's certainly nobody's interest to have the second largest school system go on strike, especially a prolonged strike. So I think that we need some leadership to try to resolve this.
Why do you think the leadership has been absent in resolving this? This is, as you said, the nation's second largest school district. Some 500,000 school children are affected by this, and their parents and the workers and everyone else.
I think part of the problem is just that the district is autonomous. It doesn't report to the city. Does report to the county office of education, but it has a lot of autonomy, and therefore no other figure. Outside of, say, perhaps the governor, has that kind of authority to kind of force the two sides to come together. And that's part of the problem. If this were New York City or Chicago, where the mayor has control, it would be very different.
What about Alex Caputo-Pearl's belief that Austin Buettner and other pro-charter school members of the board really have a bigger vision here, and that is to break up the district and to sell pieces off and make it a for-profit institution and do something along the lines of New Orleans or Newark?
Well, I don't know, if I would agree with that based on what I've seen. I would say that there is the concern about the proliferation of charter schools is legitimate. LA has more charter schools than any city in the country. There's no oversight for those schools, and many of those schools are under-enrolled, and it has wreaked havoc in this community. And so I think raising it's a concern, even though it's not an issue that they can bargain over, is important. And I think in many ways, those are some of the background issues that are driving this conflict.
Right. And also the fact that the more kids who go to charter schools, the less money the district has.
That's right. But, this is easily blamed the parents who've chosen those schools. Parents are going to choose. No one's blaming the parents who choose to put their kids in private school that they're undermining the district. So I think you have to be careful with that argument. I do think the question of how charter schools are being authorized does need to be raised, and there needs to be some accountability for the impact it has on public education.
Well, how much control does the district or could the district have over charters that it refuses to exercise?
The county actually has been authorizing charter schools, more charter schools than the district. I think that where the oversight comes from is a political matter. And there is a new governor, new state commissioner of education here in California, both of whom are less supportive of charter schools. So I expect to see some changes.
But doesn't it come down to the district schools need to be able to compete with the charter schools? Because there is something appealing to a lot of parents in these charter schools.
Absolutely. But we've also set district schools up to be in a weak position to compete because as they lose students, they also lose resources.
Mm-hmm.
And the students they're more likely to be left with are the students with the greatest needs, special ed students, English learners. The charter schools are not particularly interested in serving those students. And so what you end up with is a very unequal situation where the district is left with a disproportionate share of the most disadvantaged children. And we should all be concerned about the lack of resources available to serve those kids and the large class sizes in district schools.
And can you explain how that works? Because I thought charters were legally mandated to hold a lottery for kids and not discriminate when it comes to admissions.
They are legally mandated to hold lotteries, but if you don't provide services, parents aren't going to choose your school. And many charter schools don't have adequate services for either special ed students or English learners. Now, I have to be careful. There are some charters that do, so you can't generalize about charter schools. But I would say, in general, that's the pattern. You'll see families that have one child in a charter school, but their student who has learning disabilities in a public school. And so it creates a very unequal playing field.
And then the bigger structural problem as well, as we discussed with Alex Caputo-Pearl, is the looming massive payments to retired teachers for their pensions and health care benefits.
That's the big issue. And in comparison to the funds lost because of lower enrollment, that's a much bigger issue. And I'm not sure what's going to be done about that. That's where the state's going to need to step in because several districts are experiencing hardship because of pension.
How long do you think the strike will go on?
It's not clear to me. I mean, on the one hand, not only will families be affected because their kids will either not be in school or not learning very much because teachers won't be there, and the disruption will, I think, bring some pressure on both the union and the district to settle. But then there's the question, how long can teachers afford to be without a paycheck? Many teachers, as we know, are already, you know, have a difficult circumstance, and therefore not being paid will be a real hardship. So, but if they go out too short a time, then the question will be, well, what did you do it for? What did you accomplish? So it's hard to tell what they will end up doing if and when they go on strike.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Pedro Noguera, Distinguished Professor of Education at UCLA. Coming up, how immigration policies are playing out in the Central Valley with many undocumented workers living in a culture of fear. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump's border wall and the government shutdown over it has dominated the news. Everyone has an opinion, including California's new governor, Gavin Newsom. He raised the issue at his inauguration yesterday.
But all kids, not just the children of a governor and a filmmaker, should have a good life in California. They shouldn't be ripped away from their parents at the border. And nor should they be left hungry. Nor should they be left hungry when politicians seek to pour billions into a wall that should never be built.
But all this focus on the wall has taken some attention away from the federal government's efforts to deport undocumented immigrants already here. California is trying to protect them with its sanctuary state policy. But an article in the New York Review of Books shows that the policy may also have some unintended consequences, particularly in the rural farming community of the San Joaquin Valley. Author and journalist Michael Greenberg wrote that article. It's called In the Valley of Fear. And in it, he really focuses on the culture of fear among the migrant workers in the San Joaquin Valley. And there were some really compelling descriptions in it, with families afraid to leave their house, afraid to go to the market, afraid to be in public at all because an ICE officer might be lurking in a car across the street. I spoke with Michael Greenberg earlier.
Yes. Yes, this has been a really, really troubling and unfortunate byproduct of the Trump administration's anti-immigration policies. And coupled with California's sanctuary law, which is a wonderful law in spirit, ICE has responded by going to war, essentially, with California. And former Attorney General Jeff Sessions was pretty clear about this, how absolutely aghast he was at California's laws. So you have a cordon of terror in this quite isolated valley, made famous by Steinbeck and Carey McWilliams, and one of the highest value farm valleys in the world, dependent on cheap labor. And these laborers, some of whom have been here for 10, 15, 20, 25 years, their children are citizens who were born here, are really living in a state of constant fear and surveillance from ICE, both in marked and unmarked cars. Now, this is a rural area, so it can be very obvious when you're being followed, when ICE agents are parked, when you pick up your children at school, when they're parked in the parking lot of your apartment building where you live, casing out people in supermarkets. There's just a sense, a very strong sense of fear, and a sense that the government policy is to deport as many undocumented immigrants as they can and have others leave on their own because it just becomes untenable to live in this state of fear.
You tell the story of a young woman, an 18-year-old young woman named Rufina Garcia, and what happened to her family when her parents thought that they were being followed by an unmarked ICE car. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, Rufina is 18 years old, the only adult in a family of five children. Her parents had come here 16 and a half years ago when she was one and a half. All her siblings, four of them, were born here. And both parents worked in the fields. They were migrant workers. They worked mostly the San Joaquin Valley. Maybe they went over to the coastal valley, occasionally into Watsonville, and they picked, and that's how they lived. And ICE started to case them out. They noticed ICE cars following them, hanging around them when they picked up their children at school. And really, it turned out ICE was interested in the brother of the father, who had an old DUI. A DUI that had been settled and did not involve reckless driving, but nevertheless they were after him, as ICE often is, with infractions that they can use as deportable offenses. Santos, as the father is called, and Marcelina, his wife, dropped their daughter, not Rufina, but a younger daughter, off at RFK High School in Kern County, and ICE followed them. ICE flashed its lights, pulled them over. Santos obeyed. As the ICE agents approached the car, he panicked, afraid that he would be wrenched from his children because he was undocumented, drove off at a high speed, was pursued, and his car flipped over and both Rufina's parents were killed.
Mm. And that really set off protests and outrage in that community of undocumented workers. Even though other things had happened in the past with ICE, this was seen as particularly egregious because why? This couple hadn't done anything wrong?
They had never done anything wrong, and they were hardworking farm workers, four of whose children were American citizens, and needed farm workers, by the way. There's the biggest shortage in perhaps 90 years of labor in the San Joaquin Valley, partly because of anti-immigrant laws. And so you could look at it in one way, it is an unfortunate accident. But there's another way of looking at it, and that's the way farm workers in the valley looked at it, as a galvanizing event that really was emblematic of the state of terror and fear and surveillance that they were living in. And they saw this as rather a natural outcrop, even if an unusual one, of their situation vis-a-vis the immigration authorities.
Well, as you said earlier, Jeff Sessions basically took the sanctuary law that the state adopted as a provocation. And I guess I'm wondering if people now see that as there's an unfortunate consequence to this law, that perhaps if the law hadn't been implemented, ICE wouldn't be exerting such a strong presence in these communities, and that maybe they now would rather not have the sanctuary law?
Well, growers in the San Joaquin Valley, the very large landholders, big growers, would prefer that there were no sanctuary law because it's interfering with their workforce. It's definitely, it would be hard to blame California for a law that really the spirit of it was to protect its workers, its undocumented workers, badly needed for its economy, and taxpaying workers, by the way. But should the sanctuary laws, should California capitulate and give up its sanctuary laws? I wouldn't think so. I think California is within its rights and actually inspiring to the rest of the country in taking this position. But the problem is that ICE sees it as a defiance. So they say, okay, we're going to crack down further and make it really hard for everyone. And who suffers? The farm workers.
And the growers probably aren't happy about it because they have fewer workers.
Growers are very unhappy about it, and they're really beside themselves. I mean, millions of dollars in crop has been plowed under in recent years. You know, better economic opportunities in central and northern Mexico have decreased the number of Mexican workers that need to or are willing or are lured by jobs in the U.S., and certainly the cost of coming, the fear that's involved, having to pay a smuggler or a coyote, which can put you in debt for life, makes it even less attractive. But still, in southern Mexico, in Oaxaca, in Guerrero, in the poorest states of Mexico, very often inhabited by Mixteco indigenous people, this is really, at the moment, the workforce for California's farm workers. And they're very hardworking and very sort of extraordinary workers, and they're skilled. So they're underpaid, basically. Mm-hmm. Americans won't do the work. Work contractors in California have noted that when they offer $4 more than minimum wage, they can't get citizens to work. Some work contractors are offering $20 an hour, and they can't get American citizens or illegal residents to work. So these pickers are essential.
That's journalist and author Michael Greenberg. You can read his article about the San Joaquin Valley in the New York Review of Books. Coming up, what happened when Netflix tried to appease Saudi Arabia by pulling a comedy episode critical of the Crown Prince?
Thanks to MBS, the Saudis effectively own 10% of Uber, which makes complete sense. Saudi Arabia and Uber are both places women drivers don't feel safe.
Big tech and censorship next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for our TV segment. We call it TV on the Radio. No
one told you that was... This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are the 4 minutes. The actual retail price is...
Well, the last time we talked about Netflix, we were talking about Friends and the streaming giant airing that old friendly series. Now Netflix is entangled in something more serious, much less friendly, Middle East politics. Netflix has removed an episode of a show critical of the Saudi regime. It was an episode of Patriot Act, that's a news and politics comedy show starring Hasan Minhaj. Netflix only stopped the episode from airing in Saudi Arabia. Robin Wright is a contributing writer for The New Yorker. She wrote about this for the magazine. Hi there.
Hi.
So for those of us who haven't watched the episode yet, can you describe what the main points he's making in it are about Saudi Arabia?
Well, the focus of the segment was on Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And he points out that this was a man who was feted in the United States, Harvard, Houston, Hollywood, in the spring as a reformer that not only Saudi Arabia needed, but the whole Arab world needed. And he then makes the point, it blows his mind, that it took the killing of a Washington Post journalist for everyone to say...
I guess he's really not a reformer. Meanwhile, every Muslim person you know was like, yeah, no, he's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. So now would be a good time to reassess our relationship with Saudi Arabia. And I mean that as a Muslim and as an American.
So apparently the Saudis didn't like that.
No, they didn't. And Netflix was informed that the episode violated a vague but sweeping Saudi cybercrime law, which stipulates that there can be no production or preparation or transmission or even storage of material that affects public order or religious values or public morals or privacy. And it's a crime that's punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Now, obviously, that might not apply to Netflix itself, although it apparently is trying to open an office in Riyadh. But it signifies that this is considered an important crime to the Saudis. And it's one way that it has clamped down on bloggers and social activists who turn to social media to criticize the government or even make statements about policy.
How many people have been arrested under this law?
We don't know. The Saudis don't list the people it picks up. It claims not to have political prisoners. But remember that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which is nearing 100th days, was October 2nd, they still have not listed the names of the 18 people they've arrested. And 11 of them were taken to court last week, and 5 of them facing the death penalty, but we still don't know their names. So Saudi Arabia is one of the most, not only one of the most repressive governments in the world, but it is one of the most secretive in terms of its judicial proceedings.
So why would Netflix do this? Why would they cave so quickly and easily when they don't really have a big presence in Saudi Arabia? I mean, you say they want to open an office in Riyadh. They haven't done that yet. Why would they react so swiftly?
I don't work for Netflix, so I don't know what his thinking was. And that's one of the questions I ask in the article I wrote. Given its small viewership in the kingdom, and given the fact that there are so many fundamental issues of freedom of expression, things that are not only values to the American society, but that are in our American laws, and it sets such a terrible precedent that Netflix could find other countries now invoke, whether it's big markets like China or India or even Brazil under its new populist president, to try to get Netflix to withhold its material. So this could end up hurting Netflix, even if it helps it a little bit in the tiny Saudi market.
Well, one thing that comes to my mind is that Mohammed bin Salman has talked about investing in Hollywood and investing in making movies and television, and maybe Netflix is looking at that.
That's one possibility. But at the end of the day, the Saudis need the United States far more than the United States needs Saudi Arabia, in part because of energy independence, but also because the Saudis need content to provide a society which is overwhelmingly young, where somewhere around a third of the young population is unemployed in this oil-rich kingdom, and that one of the payoffs under MBS, as he's known, is to provide social content, media content, to open movie theaters. They opened a movie theater and showed Black Panther last year. And one of the interesting things will be to see how Hollywood responds to what the Saudis are doing in the way of censorship. We're entering very interesting territory in the global market as social media, streaming media, internet connections can cross borders with no problem, but authoritarian governments that have the law or financial muscle try to contain what crosses their borders. We're headed toward a real cultural conflict, a cultural war ahead.
Right, and ironically, by doing this, by trying to censor this episode, it's only given it more publicity, so more people probably have seen it than otherwise might have.
Well, it gives more publicity to the show itself, which aired on October 28th, and it took 2 months to litigate or deal with the issue of whether to pull the episode or not. I'm sure it's gotten far more viewers now. But it does ask questions that all of us have to, so the industry and individual has to answer. I mean, when I posted this, when the story went up, people were sending me comments that they were going to boycott Netflix, that there was a real outrage that Netflix put money and profit over the immorality of murder.
Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Robin Wright. She writes for The New Yorker, where you can read her story on Netflix and comedian Hasan Minhaj. Coming up, we want to keep as clean as we can and keep the bacteria away, but
we carry about 4 pounds of bacteria in our body. There's more bacterial cells in our body than there are human cells, so we are actually coexisting with them, and they're actually very important in our health.
Myths around the spread of germs, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You have no doubt heard of the 5-second rule. You drop a piece of food on the floor and you can pick it up within 5 seconds and eat it. It's okay. You won't get sick. Then there's the debate over double dipping.
Double dipped? What are you talking about? You dipped the chip, you took a bite, and you dipped again.
So?
That's like putting your whole mouth right in the dip. From now on, when you take a chip, just take one dip and end it.
Well, I'm sorry, Timmy. But I don't dip that way.
Oh, you don't, huh?
No. You dip the way you want to dip, I'll dip the way I want to dip.
Give me the chip!
Hey, hey, hey!
Okay, Seinfeld. taking on the double dipping controversy. A new book looks at that and other questions around food safety and the spread of germs, including, is it better to use a hand dryer or a paper towel after you wash your hands? Does hand sanitizer really kill all those germs? The book is called Did You Just Eat That? Two scientists explore double dipping, the 5-second rule, and other food myths in the lab. And the co-author Paul Dawson is with me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. My pleasure.
All right. First of all, let's talk about that double dipping. Just for the uninitiated, that is when you dip a chip into a dip and you eat it and then dip it again, you are spreading your germs into the communal bowl of dip?
Well, yes, you are. Timmy was right. in the book, we report on a study we did about double dipping, and we had our test subjects either dip without biting a chip, or in this case a cracker, or bite the cracker first and dip. And we tested several experiments, but we eventually got down to testing salsa dip, chocolate, and cheese dip, and found that there were 1,000 more bacteria in the salsa after biting than there were when you didn't bite, and 150, 200 in the cheese and chocolate dip. There was clearly a transfer of oral bacteria to the dip.
Okay. Let's talk about the 5-second rule. First of all, how did 5 seconds, is it just because it's one of those numbers, an evenish number, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20? Why 5 seconds? Why not 3? Why not 10? Why not 20?
You know, I don't know for sure where the actual 5 came from, but time is a factor. The longer it stays there, you get a little more, but there is significant. It transfers immediately. Really, if there's pathogens on that surface to make someone sick.
So immediately, if whatever you drop on the floor, there will be harmful bacteria adhering to that piece of food.
Right. And it depends on the floor. Most surfaces are not going to have pathogens on it. Obviously, a place like a hospital would probably be a high-risk area. Kitchen probably would be another high-risk area because that's where you're preparing food and you have raw food there, raw meat on surfaces and chance for cross-contamination. There could be the chance that you walked on something and people walked across that surface and there might be pathogens there, but most likely there's probably not going to be something to make you sick.
It just depends on the
surface.
So you're saying it is okay to drop something on the floor and eat it?
I wouldn't do it because it's a risk you don't need to take. Odds are there's probably not going to be something there. Unless it's a hospital or a kitchen.
Even though a hospital you think is a very clean place. They're always cleaning.
Yeah, but there's a lot of sick people there. Yeah,
exactly. I guess that outweighs the cleanliness factor. Well, what is the scope of the problem with foodborne illness? It seems that we probably, most of us, might be getting foodborne illnesses and not even know it, right? We think maybe it's a flu or a cold, but it might actually be a foodborne illness.
Exactly. And the CDC makes estimates each year. They estimate 48 million Americans get sick every year from foodborne illness. Plant foods actually cause about as many illnesses as meat and poultry.
Yeah, we just had that romaine recall.
Yeah, and it used to be thought that meat, poultry were a main source, but that's not really true.
But isn't it from meat, fecal, or, you know, poultry and beef fecal matter that then gets washed away and then collects on the leaves of the plants?
That's one source, actually, and now it's been found, actually, it's at the farm level where it's occurring. It's in the water, irrigation system. I guess the other way to look at it is, where are you getting sick? And about 4 out of 10 Americans eat out at least once a day. And so you might guess restaurants and delis, and the home only accounts for like 12% of those. About 63% of foodborne illness occur from eating out.
So what about the hygiene hypothesis? The idea that you should be exposing yourself to a certain level of bacteria to build up tolerance and immunity.
Obviously, we need to be exposed to bacteria and viruses at a young age and through our life to get immunity. But there also is compelling evidence that some germs build a strong immune system that are not pathogens. So exposure to non-pathogens may be good or better than challenging ourselves with pathogens. And there's a whole advancing the medical field on the microbiome, how, you know, we carry about 4 pounds of bacteria in our body, and there are more bacterial cells. Yeah, there's more bacterial cells in our body than there are human cells. So we are actually coexisting with them, and they're actually very important in our health, and there's more and more study into that.
However, you do say that there are precautions we should take. I mean, 63% of all foodborne illnesses come from restaurants, and one of the culprits you point to are menus.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, right? Everyone's handling them. They probably rarely get washed.
Right.
They're like, they're just like, you know, kind of wiped and handed to the next person.
Yeah, you don't know who, really bad. Everybody from the wait staff to patrons handle menus. So it's usually an opportunity for contamination occurs, and, you know, likely probably what's recommended is you wash your hands after you order.
Yeah.
But one study, you know, obviously found more bacteria on menus than they did toilet seats. Although toilet seats are something you clean, so that's maybe why it's not as bad as maybe menus.
Okay, so wash your hands after you order. And then when you go to the bathroom to do that and you're drying your hands, should you use one of those Dyson blade dryer things, or you should just use a paper towel?
In general, paper towels are definitely better as far as sanitation than hand dryers. A hand dryer is going to have to be pulling in air to generate the air, and so the intake is going to be concentrating anything in the air, including bacteria and viruses, on dust particles, and the dust kind of sits there and you will hold the bacteria. And then you already have bacteria in the air, obviously, from the flushing or anybody breathing and coughing and talking. Clearly, paper towels are better. Most medical facilities, if you go in those, and hospitals, do not have hand dryers, blowers. They use paper towels for that reason, because if there's obviously bacteria in the air, you don't want to spread it around.
Should you use a hand sanitizer instead? And by the way, it sounds like you're sick.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I got a cold. So I always try to think back, how did I get that? Because I kind of, when I think about that, when we get sick, somehow a disease agent had to enter our body, whether we touched the surface and then touched our eye or our mouth or our ear, or we ate something that was contaminated. And that kind of makes me think a lot. And as far as hand sanitizers, they are better than nothing, but nothing, they are not as good as hand washing. Hand washing is kind of the gold standard when it comes to cleaning your hand. Getting the bacteria, viruses off your hand, and a good hand washing is much better than sanitizers.
Really? Because it says on the bottle that it kills 99.9% of germs.
And in the bacterial world, we deal with log values, and 99.9% is 3 logs. And if you have even 6 logs, which is 1 million bacteria on a surface, you've only gotten rid of half of that with 99.9%. So there's plenty there left.
I guess I'm wondering, after reading your book, how do we not become obsessive compulsive neurotics and fear touching anything and constantly washing our hands? Like, that's really no way to live.
Certainly, we eat 3 meals a day, 365 days a year, and most times don't get sick. No need to be paranoid, just kind of common sense, really washing hands on a regular basis, not touching your face. If you haven't washed your hands, you know, you'd be going through the hallways and touching doors and knobs. And so really common sense really is the best approach. And we're not really advocating any kind of germaphobe approach to that.
Paul, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's Paul Dawson. His new book is called Did You Just Eat That? 2 Scientists Explore Double Dipping, the 5-Second Rule, and Other Food Myths in the Lab. And that's it for us here at Press Play. If you want to know more about the looming teacher strike, just head over to kcrw.com/teachers-strike to ask your questions and follow all of our coverage. Thanks for joining us. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.